This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss how to train smart and recover strong with naturopath Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We'll dissect the psychology of conflict with author Cynthia Rivard. We'll learn about the five ingredients that help with the symptoms of perimenopause with registered dietitian and cookbook author Jen Salib Huber. And lastly, we'll learn about the five types of obesity with author and functional medicine practitioner Dr. Aaron Hartman, MD. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. How does your brain know when to breathe, digest food, or fight off an infection? The answer lies in interoception, the body's hidden sixth sense. Interoception is the process through which the nervous system constantly monitors what's happening inside us, such as your heartbeat, blood pressure, and digestion, to keep everything balanced. A research team from Scripps Research and the Allen Institute has received a major award from the National Institute of Health to create the first detailed map or atlas of this internal sensory system. Unlike the five classic senses that detect the outside world, interoception relies on a vast network of neurons found deep within organs like the heart, lungs, and stomach. The scientists plan to trace how sensory neurons connect the brain and spinal cord to the body's organs using high-resolution imaging and genetic tools. Their goal is to understand how these circuits work together to maintain health. By decoding interoception, researchers hope to uncover new ways to treat conditions such as chronic pain, autoimmune diseases, and high blood pressure, and gain a deeper understanding of how the brain keeps the body in balance. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Colleen Hartwick in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild-crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores. As we move into colder months, many of us are taking our workouts indoors, whether it's a gym, a basement setup, or an online class. But winter can also be a time when injuries start to creep up. Today we're talking about how to train smarter, not just harder, and what science tells us about preventing injuries and improving recovery. Dr. Colleen Hartwick joins me again. She's a naturopathic doctor with a special interest in sports medicine, injury prevention, and performance recovery. Welcome back to the show, Colleen. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I'm so happy to be here to chat with you again.
So finally, we're going to talk about something you know something about, right?
Yes, as a former competitive athlete in a few different sports, and my undergrad was actually in kinesiology. I'm like deeply passionate about sports and athletics, so super happy to be here to talk about this topic.
So we were going to talk about my tennis elbow. Maybe we should stick to broader issues.
Yeah, maybe we could talk about that on a one-on-one appointment.
Okay. Why do we see so many tweaks and strains and overuse injuries once people move their workouts indoors?
Yeah, I think there's probably a couple of different pieces that relate to the uptick in injuries this time of year. First thing is just to do with the cold temperatures. So cold temperatures negatively impact our connective tissue, so results in reductions in flexibility, feeling a little bit more stiff. We see that when we're exposed to a cold weather, our blood vessels constrict, which means less blood flow to than our ligaments, our tendons, our muscles, and that makes them much more rigid, so more likely to overextend them and sprain and strain them. I mean, secondly is, again, tied to this time of year in the cold weather, people are usually, you know, just waking up in the morning and, you know, hopping into the gym first thing, or maybe at the end of the workday, you know, jumping out of the car and again, heading indoors for the gym. So they're not getting that gradual warm up that we tend to get in the warmer months of the year. And then lastly, see this kind of often with indoor routines, they tend to be a little bit more repetitive in terms of the types of movements. So, you know, walking or running on a treadmill, cycling, strength circuits, that repetitive type of motion can be associated with more wear and tear that could potentially evolve into an injury.
I think light plays into it too. If you're working out in the morning or you're working out even late afternoon, like what used to be like a bright sunny run becomes like working out in your basement and it's darker, and like it changes your focus.
No, absolutely. And here on the coast, for your listeners, if you don't remember, I'm on Vancouver Island, which is a temperate rainforest, and we're actually right now set to get about 35 millimeters of rain today. So that gray weather, and with that less cortisol, less dopamine, less serotonin. So we can be a little bit less energized, a little bit less focused when we go into the workout.
So my warm-up goes on for about 20 minutes. Do you think that there's such a thing as a seasonal warm-up? Is there something we should be doing differently in winter?
What do you do in your warm-up?
Oh, gosh. I have a partially torn Achilles. So a lot of it is building up the muscles around my ankles and my legs. Also, you know, I'm no spring chicken, so I got to make sure my flexibility is good.
Yeah, I hear you on that. I just turned 40 this year, and I'm noticing I've got to be a little bit more careful with things like stretching and warming up. My body is definitely speaking to me, especially with some old injuries. So yeah, seasonal warming up, I think, is really important. Again, with the colder weather, we're just more prone to sprains and strains and injury. There's really two aspects of warming up we could look at. So the first one being a passive warm-up, and that's like literally warming up your room. So turning the heater on, I've got the wood stove going, wearing warmer clothing. I just think of, you know, Rocky in a sweatsuit helping you to maintain heat so you get better blood flow and better flexibility. And then there's the more active or dynamic warm-up. So like physically moving your body, walking, running, maybe some plyometrics to help increase core temperature, again, improve blood flow, improving flexibility. And for active warm-up, it's something like 10 minutes. Could be more, longer like yours, like a 20-minute, but on the low end, it's a 10 minutes of, again, some sort of dynamic running, walking, plyometric exercise to literally warm up the tissues.
I have the luxury of having like a full gym in my house. So I can afford to take extra time to both warm up and cool down because there's no driving back and forth to facilities. So that's part of the reason I do it is because I can.
Well, and if you're driving to a facility, depending on the age of your car, you know, heat up the car, turn the heated seat on. Make sure you've got the heater on so that your body is physically warm before you start to move.
We sometimes hear talk about something called load management. Can you explain how that helps prevent injuries?
Sure thing. So load management is sort of a systematic approach to increasing exercise workload, and that could be increasing your intensity, your volume, so like how many sets and reps you're doing, how long you're working out, as well as it includes recovery. I think oftentimes athletes and people who are exercising underappreciate the role that recovery plays in adaptation to training. I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But yeah, load management is sort of a systematized way to help reduce injury risk. And again, especially important this time of year with, again, that cold weather exposure increasing the likelihood of injury. And a good rule to play by as it pertains to load management is something known as the 10% rule. So what this rule stipulates is every week that you're working out, whether it's at home or at a gym, is to add no more than 10% of your workload. So 10% in terms of distance. So if you've been running 1 kilometer, run, you know, 1.1 kilometers, 10% increase in duration and or 10% increase in intensity. So this gradual increase in essentially what you're demanding of the body helps to reduce the risk of injury.
When people do get sore, they reach for, you know, anti-inflammatories, or they might even go for an ice bath. But is that really the best thing to do?
No, it's a great question. So, you know, there's a pro and con to inflammation. I think we've talked about it in previous conversation.
Yeah.
But you're right. Jumping right to something that's anti-inflammatory, like a cold plunge or maybe an over-the-counter anti-inflammatory medication, can actually blunt our adaptations to sport. So when we're working out, cause all these microscopic tears to muscle, which gives rise to an inflammatory response. But that inflammation, as it relates to exercise, is considered more like positive or good inflammation, because it acts as a stimulus to get the proverbial gains, to stimulate myogenesis, or the development of new muscle fibers. So we don't want to blunt inflammation, because that may, again, impair our recovery time and our adaptation to our workout. So it might take longer, again, to get the gains, whether it's increasing in size and strength or speed. So what we really want to do instead of blunting inflammation is to help our body modulate it, because too much inflammation can also be problematic for training and for adaptation to exercise. When we're in chronic inflammation, that can result in overtraining. I don't know if you or any of your audience members have overtrained. I've done it at least 3 times in my life where there's been too much inflammation, not enough recovery time. And then that results in things like fatigue, losing muscle mass, yep. And gaining weight, but not the desired weight, actually gaining body fat. So we don't want too much inflammation. We don't want too little inflammation or to suppress inflammation excessively. We want the Goldilocks just right amount of inflammation. So instead of excessive icing or jumping into a cold plunge, you know, right after your workout to blunt inflammation, I tend to opt for gentler, more modulating practices, really focusing on the diet and including anti-inflammatory and antioxidant nutrients like turmeric or bromelain, the ever-important omega-3s from fish oil. You know, if you did a really hard workout and you are feeling sore, it's not to say you can't do something like a cold plunge, but I would probably wait 3 to 4 hours after the workout so you can kind of capitalize on the acute inflammation, but then put a pause on more chronic inflammation. Then after the first 24 hours, again, if you're feeling achy and sore, you could do some alternate contrast hydrotherapy. So going, you know, something like 3 or 4 minutes in some hot water or warm water, and 30 seconds rather of cold, alternating that at least 3 times. And that has been shown to promote healing, boost circulation, and speed up the recovery time so you can get back to the gym.
Are there supplements that you would recommend for people who are training regularly who want to prevent injuries or recover faster?
Absolutely. So I think the most important nutrient category to help with recovery is first getting enough protein. If you're wanting to build and repair muscle, muscle is mostly it's mostly water. And then after that, it's mostly protein. So making sure you get enough dietary protein, also getting enough carbohydrates along with protein really helps to promote recovery and getting protein back into the working muscle so that they can recover and repair at a faster rate. I mentioned before, when you asked me about inflammation, including nutrients that have anti-inflammatory or antioxidant effects. So this could be, you know, some fish oil or eating more fish, adding in herbs and spices that have anti-inflammatory effects, like curcumin from turmeric, the herb boswellia. Actually, you know, when I was training much harder years ago for climbing, I'd use a combination of some enzymes, curcumin, boswellia, and that really helped me recover quickly and get back to the climbing gym without the typical sort of DOMS aches and pains that I was experiencing. Adding in nutrients as well that help with collagen synthesis. Collagen is like the scaffolding of all of our tissues, including muscle. So you could take something like a marine collagen supplement, as well as some extra vitamin C that helps build good quality collagen. And then lastly, to help with recovery, may look at some creatine that helps with recovery time and adaptation to training, can help us get the gains and also help with rehydrating the muscles. And depending on where you're at, female versus male, giving some consideration to iron. Us women are a little bit more prone to iron deficiency, and iron is also really crucial for collagen synthesis. So those would be the nutrients and perhaps supplements to look at to promote good recovery.
You know, my perspective is, you know, it's all interrelated. And one of the key factors that I found over the years is the connection between sleep and exercise. Better exercise helps you sleep, and better sleep helps you build muscle and recover. How do you think the two factor together?
So people think that the gains they get from working out happen at the gym. They actually don't. That just acts as the trigger to cause adaptation. So again, building more muscle, getting stronger, getting faster. Actually, where the gains happen is when we're sleeping. So you're totally right that sleep is so crucial for both recovery and adaptation to our workouts. So during sleep, and especially an important sleep phase called deep sleep or slow wave sleep, we produce some really important hormones that help with recovery and adaptation to our workouts, namely growth hormone and another hormone called IGF-1. And we produce actually the bulk of these hormones in our first sleep cycle. So the first 90 minutes of sleep, about 60 to 70% of our total daily growth hormone is released. So sleep is so important, and especially things like a consistent bedtime. Doesn't have to be exactly at the same time, but, you know, try to go to bed at the same time every night so that you can capitalize on that first sleep cycle and that big bolus of growth hormone and IGF-1 that really helps with recovery and getting the gains from whatever training regimen you're doing. When we're chronically underslept, so not getting enough hours of sleep, not getting enough deep sleep, maybe we have some broken sleep because we're waking up because we're stressed out, what we can see is a blunting in sports recovery, because again, we'll be producing less growth hormone. We'll also see higher levels of our stress hormone cortisol, and when cortisol levels are high, it stimulates muscle breakdown, which is obviously counterproductive to recovering from working out. And we have more chronic inflammation when we're underslept. So sleep is it's probably one of, other than getting to the gym consistently, it's the most important thing you can do for recovery.
Indeed. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
That was Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the psychology of conflict on The Tonic. Does your reflection match how you feel, or are stubborn areas holding you back? At Form, Face, and Body, they specialize in restoring your youthful glow and sculpting the body you desire so your outer appearance reflects your inner vitality. Visit formfacebody.ca and see how they can help you rediscover your confidence. Call 416-447-6176 to schedule your complimentary consultation and reclaim your vitality. Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50. But the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Cynthia Rivard is a leadership and intuition expert, author, and environmental advocate. She advocates for ethical practices and proactive solutions that support businesses and humanity into the future. Her books, Hope for a New Era and A New Breed of Leader, Cynthia invites readers on a journey of self-discovery and expansion of their purpose, leadership, and concession-building skills, fostering the heart-led, compassionate communities we need in order to heal and create peace. And you can learn more about Cynthia at cynthiarivard.com. All proceeds from her books will be donated to globalrisingtide.org, the purpose-driven conscious leaders community that she founded that is contributing to raise human consciousness and end global warming. Welcome to the show, Cynthia. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Excellent. So today we're gonna try and dissect the psychology of conflict, because there's so much conflict in the world today. Are you up for the task?
We'll have to go fast. Let's do it.
Okay. So I understand that you think that human instinctual programming resists change, even when it's for the greater good. How does knowing this, if that's true, help us respond differently in moments of conflict or fear? Maybe we should break that down a bit.
Yes. Well, first of all, two different scenarios, but if you can think about conflict when it comes up for you, your initial reaction might be to fight because you feel threatened. That's instinctual programming. There is more than likely no physical threat or reason for you to be threatened, but that's your subconscious kicking up. So if you recognize that, you can approach it, you can choose to approach the conversation differently with curiosity as opposed to feeling a need to defend yourself. In the case of fear, what typically I think most people can relate to, if you think about a new goal you've created for yourself, quite often what happens if it's a little bit of a stretch, even though it's not scary, we don't see it as something we fear. Maybe it's really going to be good for us. But what will happen is what people call self-sabotaging behaviors. And that is your subconscious throwing up resistance to try and keep you where you are because it sees where you are as safe and that new goal as a potential threat because it's new. That's all. So it might come up as procrastination or overwhelm, analysis paralysis, those kinds of things. But when you recognize it's happening, that's the key step, just building awareness. Because when you recognize it, you can reassure yourself you're safe, you know, assuming you've done your due diligence, and then break it down to the smallest possible action step you can take, a little micro action to get into motion. Because once your subconscious recognizes you're still safe, it'll start to lessen the resistance it's putting up for you.
I understand you also think that a lot of our modern struggles, whether it be like political polarization or social unrest or even loneliness, are rooted in the same survival instincts. So how do we shift away from those modes?
Well, again, recognizing it's happening, and what you want to do is look for it in yourself first. All of us need to lead ourselves, recognize and heal these things going on within ourselves so that we can lead by example. You know, show up with calm and compassion and diplomacy in the height of conflict. Lead by example. But once you've started practicing doing that, you'll recognize it in others and it will help you nurture compassion for them and your ability to listen to them because you have compassion and more of an understanding for what they're going through. So that's how it helps us move forward, to just recognize it's going on first and foremost.
Okay, we're coming up to the part of the interview where I've got some viewpoints. I'm going to interject. So, you describe a situation where there's extreme individualism in modern society on the one hand, and also destructive tribalism on the other. And you know, I think the chief culprit for that is social media, and it's how we're socialized generally. You know, in the West, you know, the Western thought of, you know, personal freedoms, etc. So how can we overcome that and sort of build community when nobody really seems to be interested in building bridges towards people with opposing viewpoints or different viewpoints?
I think, well, it has to, again, start with ourselves and a desire to see the humanity in each other and build compassion. If you lead, those people of opposing viewpoints aren't going to feel as threatened and as confrontational around you. If you lead with compassion and curiosity and wanting to really understand them or help them out, you know, when we talk about building community, what does that look like? It just getting to know your neighbors, first of all. And, you know, typically we don't ask them what their political viewpoints are. They're just a fellow human that lives nearby that might need something from us. But making an intentional effort, because our society in this country anyway, we tend to move around a lot. And so a lot of us don't have long-term roots in a particular community. You have to be intentional in getting out of the house and getting involved or meeting your neighbors or something like that. You can certainly build community online and support people who aren't in your immediate neighborhood. Maybe your family is on the other side of the country. They're still your community because you support one another. So there's a few ways of doing that, but the intention should always be to look for common ground, commonalities, and, you know, just see people as individuals rather than making assumptions about them and thinking they're nothing like you, because we're all more alike than we're different.
So I'm up in Toronto, Canada, and I believe you're in the United States.
I am.
I think the problem, I think what Canadians see is you have leadership there that's sort of leaning into quite the opposite. And, you know, everybody's under more stress. I think everybody, if you polled everybody in North America, I think they are less optimistic about where the world is going than where it was not too long ago. And I think, you know, I think the problem is everybody is sort of thinking about themselves and are being trained to do more of that.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think when it's top down, it makes it really hard. Like these things you're saying, sure, I agree with them in principle. Mm-hmm. But in practice, I mean, what does it actually mean that when you have leadership that is basically saying, well, you know, what's in it for me? What am I going to do? I want to be better. I want this. I want more money in my bank account. I want this. I want to get rid of those people. You know, all those things. Like, yeah. That's an onslaught. I don't think that's easily broached.
Well, and certainly as an individual, we can't solve that, but we can choose not to follow that example. You know, there's
can
a
we
lot.
Though? Can we though? Can we though? Can we just choose yes. to not to follow that example?
That goes back to recognizing what's going on. The tribalism, when we talk about dysfunctional tribalism,
It's,
you know, this one movement bonding together and villainizing everyone else, but then the other side, the extreme other side, feeling under attack and lashing back. And so you have constant conflict, but it's actually social media really does not help, because there's so many more of us in the middle that don't want to be part of a fight. We want unity and community and, I don't know, lower grocery bills. We don't want to be lashing out at our neighbors who think differently.
I've discussed it with others who've come on the show. I think there isn't as many middle as you think there are anymore. Like, I think the middle is actually being eroded. I champion the middle. Mm-hmm. I think I agree with you. I think most of us philosophically are in the middle and aren't looking for conflict.
Yeah.
But I that's not the direction I see the world going in.
Well, I feel like a lot of people, when you are watching social media or listening to the news, you feel like you need to pick sides.
Yeah.
But you really don't, because when you step back and listen, I mean, you do if you're voting and you have to make a choice.
Fair.
But when you step back and listen to different viewpoints, which is really a primary component to building consensus, we have to listen to different viewpoints. If we all thought the same, there'd never be progress. We have to have differing viewpoints, and we have to embrace that as a possibility for progress when we're able to communicate with one another. We don't have to be pulled into the fight. And when you're willing to really understand the varied different perspectives, because it really isn't just left or right in my country. There's lots of variations and different ideas on both sides. And usually, if situations are complex, the best paths forward come out when you couple together varying ideas from both ways of looking at it, if that makes sense. And if you like the middle, as I do, because that's the only way to build progress, you know, if you're really, really leaning toward one direction, eventually there's going to be a boomerang effect and, you know, go launching in the other direction, and you just stay in struggle.
I'm going to end the interview with this thought, and I'm going to invite you back. I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to ask you to come back, and I want you to think about it, and okay, we'll explore it next time. I actually think, with all due respect to the lovely American neighbors, your political system, I think, makes it problematic because there only are two choices. And so when there's two, there actually isn't a middle. There's only one side or the other. And I think that's actually a problem, or it's become a problem for you. When you come back, if you'd like to, mm-hmm, I'd like to hear how you think we can learn to actually come to the point of view that differences actually make us stronger. Will you come back and tell us how to practically get there?
Absolutely. Yes, because we want practical steps forward. I hear you. Thank you for having me on today. I enjoyed speaking with you.
We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss a cookbook for those in perimenopause on The Tonic. Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to organic, local, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since opening in Toronto in 1983. They're a one-stop shop for health and wellness, offering organic produce, natural grocery, natural beauty and skincare products, and a holistic dispensary for natural supplements and more. The Carrot Kitchen and coffee bars serve delicious meals and drinks using high-quality ingredients sourced from local farmers and suppliers that prioritize organic, non-GMO, and/or sustainable practices. Visit one of their two locations in Toronto today. Shop the Big Carrot on Instacart now. This cold and flu season, discover the power of medicinal mushrooms. Rich in antioxidants and known to naturally support your immune system, medicinal mushrooms are one of nature's most powerful defenders. Trusted by Canadians for over 20 years, CanPrev Natural Health now offers medicinal mushroom supplements. Every capsule combines both fruiting body extract and mycelium, providing the full spectrum of medicinal compounds for a full spectrum of benefits. Gentle enough for daily use so you can stay supported all season long. Now available at your local health food store.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Jen Salib Huber is a Canadian registered dietitian, naturopathic doctor, and intuitive eating counselor. And she's on a mission to help women thrive in midlife. A leading voice in the non-diet space for women in midlife, she helps women navigate the physical and emotional changes of menopause. Salib Huber connects with readers in the Midlife Feast podcast. You can find her at menopausenutritionist.ca and follow her on Instagram and YouTube at menopause.nutritionist. Welcome to the show, Jen. How are you?
I'm great, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
So what inspired you to write Eat to Thrive During Menopause?
Well, 10 years ago, I was in perimenopause early. I was 37, 38 years old, and I found myself in this space of needing to understand what was happening. Even as a healthcare practitioner, 10 years ago, nobody was talking about perimenopause. And when I found that hormone therapy wasn't going to be the saving grace that I wanted it to be, I, you know, really decided that I wanted to explore what role food and nutrition might be able to play in not only managing the symptoms that I was having, the hot flashes, the night sweats, the mood changes, but also helping to prepare me for this next season of life, this postmenopausal season where I'm going to spend 30 to 40% of my life.
It's interesting. It's only recently that people have sort of used the phrase perimenopause. They say symptoms of menopause, but that's actually not accurate. It's actually the symptoms of perimenopause that you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we want to be accurate, we could say that it's the menopause transition. And so the menopause transition is the time from perimenopause, which is the 8 to 10 years before the final menstrual period, through to postmenopause, which is everything after.
So I understand that you think there are five key ingredients that will help manage the symptoms of menopause. What are the symptoms that you're focusing in on? And what are those five ingredients, nutrients that should be the focus of the diet?
Well, and when we're talking about symptoms, it's really easy to look online and see lists of 34, 60, 100 symptoms, but we can actually come up with a list of 9 or 10 that are most common. The most common are what we call the vasomotor symptoms: hot flashes, night sweats, even heart palpitations, sleep changes, waking up at 3 in the morning, mood changes. Those are kind of the top three. And when I was looking into the research and when I was looking at my own experience of how can I come up with a guideline or a framework for eating that doesn't involve having to look at lists of food and put everything into an app and count and measure and track, I kind of came up with these categories or these buckets, these key ingredients. And the first is soy and phytoestrogens. So for people who may never have heard the term phytoestrogen, this is a plant-based molecule that looks a little bit like our body's own estrogen, can bind to the receptors, and can help alleviate some of the symptoms that we associate with declining estrogen, specifically those hot flashes.
What are the foods that have phytoestrogens in them? I presume it's plant-based, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. So the most abundant source of phytoestrogens comes from soy foods. So this could be soybeans like edamame, this could be tofu, tempeh, soy milk, that kind of thing. All plants have some phytoestrogens, but the other category of foods that contains a significant amount would be flax. So flax seeds, lots of people are familiar with that. Ground flax seeds are good sources of phytoestrogens as well.
And in your cookbook, can you give some examples of dishes that you make that would be abundant in phytoestrogens?
So one of my favorites is actually tofu scramble. So lots of people start the day with scrambled eggs, and making tofu scramble is just as easy as scrambled eggs. And so I love having that in the fridge, and I can have that as a meal any time of day. We all love, you know, eggs for a supper meal even. But I also like to suggest that people try substituting regular milk with soy milk. So I have some overnight oat recipes. I have some muffin recipes. There's lots of ways that you can just substitute whatever milk you're using with soy milk.
One of the other ingredients I understand is protein, right?
Absolutely.
So why do you think protein is so important?
Well, protein, I think most people who aren't living under a rock have, especially if you're in the midlife forest, you've heard about protein being important. But protein is more than just building muscle. It also helps us to feel full and satisfied. It helps our brain to make neurotransmitters. It helps our body to make enzymes. And as we get older, we do need a little bit more because our body isn't as good at using it as it was when we were 20. So including what I call a main character protein on your plate at most meals, which for most people is going to fall in line with 25 or 30 grams of protein. Maybe the size of a deck of cards is kind of a good reference point. But trying to plan your day around including that main character protein will certainly help you thrive in midlife.
And do you espouse plant-based protein over like meat sources or fish or dairy? Do you have a favorite protein yourself?
Well, you know, I think that's a great question because there's certainly a lot of camps about what is best. And as an intuitive eating dietitian, I really try and stay away from that, you know, good, bad, either or language. I like to say plant forward has its benefits. So including plant-based proteins on your plate more often certainly can help with your protein intake. And certain types of plant protein, especially soy, are considered complete protein. So they're really on par with other animal-based proteins. But all the proteins can fit on your plate. But my personal favorite is actually edamame. That's my go-to. I have almost every day. It's so easy.
Yeah, I mean, mostly when I have edamame, I'm at a restaurant and it's, you know, it's been steamed and I'm shelling it. Do you have a recipe that you use with the edamame?
Absolutely. There are several in my cookbook. There's a soba noodle recipe that includes edamame. But my best tip for including edamame easily is to buy the frozen shelled edamame. You can keep it in your freezer. You can grab a handful. You can have it as a snack. You can throw it in a stir fry. You can put it in a salad. It's really easy.
Next on your list is calcium. What do you say should be the amount of calcium that a woman in perimenopause should be having?
So anybody who is in over the age of 50, depending on the country you live in, but we're in Canada, so over the age of 50, the guidelines are 1,200 milligrams. And most people know that calcium is good for your bones, but some people don't know that the reason why we need to have such a bank of calcium in our bones is for our heart. Our heart requires regular daily levels of calcium. And so if we're including these calcium-rich foods, we're limiting the number of withdrawals that our body has to take from our bank of calcium, meaning our bones. So including those calcium-rich sources, which could be from dairy foods if people tolerate them, From non-dairy beverages, which could include fortified soy milks or fortified yogurt, those kinds of things, or leafy greens, and tofu. If tofu is made with calcium, if it's calcium set, which will be on the label, it's also a great source of calcium.
In your experience with the people that you see in your practice, are women getting enough calcium when they're in perimenopause?
Typically not. And I think it's a really important message to get out there because, you know, certainly when we're in our 20s and anybody who's been pregnant, the message about calcium is loud and clear. But as we get, you know, into our 40s and 50s, sometimes we kind of forget about it and it takes a back burner. So it's a really great opportunity to kind of bring that back into your life in a meaningful way.
Do you speak to supplements in the context of your book and in your practice?
So for those five key ingredients, I do have a section on each of the supplements so that I'm, you know, if people have questions about what is the best type of calcium, how much they should take, things right. They should know, there's definitely some information in there as well.
So when you're telling women in particular to have a certain amount of calcium, are you also suggesting they take vitamin K or vitamin D to help metabolize the calcium in an effective way?
And I talk about each of those in the book. I think the most important thing to recognize is that, you know, with calcium supplements, vitamin D plays a really big role and helping the absorption from the gut. Vitamin K as well may help with helping the calcium to get to where we want it to go. We don't have enough data to say that the vitamin K supplements at this point are as effective as vitamin K rich foods. And so I break that down a little bit as well. But, you know, with calcium, the data is much stronger for foods than supplements. And even the recommendations for calcium supplementation have changed quite a bit over the last 10 years. And most people are told it's probably best to include the foods first and then use supplements to fill the gaps.
Really quickly, what is your favorite calcium recipe in your cookbook?
Oh my gosh, there are so many. But you know, I love chia seeds. And so there's a chia seed pudding that my whole family loves. And it's really easy. It's also made with soy milk. So it includes, you get the fiber, you get some protein, you get some of the omega-3s, which is one of the other key ingredients. But it's also a great source of calcium.
So let's talk about omega-3s.
Yeah.
Do you recommend supplementation or can you actually get enough through diet?
So for people who enjoy fish and like to include fish, and that doesn't have to be fresh fish, that can include canned fish, and I do recommend that as well. Including those foods two or three times a week, I've got a great recipe for sweet potato salmon cakes that makes it really easy to include them. But for people who can include those two to three times a week, you can meet most of your needs or all your needs really through food. For people who don't like to include fish, but aren't opposed to taking supplements to, you know, augment their intake of omega-3s, I think that can be helpful. But the plant-based sources of that omega-3 precursor, alpha-linoleic acid, are also associated with better health outcomes in, you know, as we get older and postmenopause. So I don't want people to think that, you know, flax and chia and walnuts and all those nuts and seeds don't have value. They absolutely do, especially in the context of also including fish.
Most of the people that come on the show that speak to omega-3s are of the view that really none of us are getting enough in our diet. I mean, I eat fish at least once a week, and that's not even enough, right? So aren't we at the stage where we pretty much have to supplement? I've actually started supplementing within the last year with omegas.
Yeah, and I think it's a really good question. And so one of the things that hasn't been answered yet in human studies is how much do we actually need? So there is no RDA in either Canada or the US about how many milligrams of EPA and DHA, the active omega-3s, are enough to increase our blood levels to a point where we can actually measure the outcome of that. Versus when we look at patterns of eating where people are including fish two to three times a week, we do see that it's associated with reduced risks of heart disease, of, you know, improved cognitive health, that kind of thing. So I also personally take omega-3 supplements a few times a week because I want to make sure that my levels are on the adequate side. But I think it's really important for people to know that we haven't actually determined what the adequate intake is. So a lot of it right now is kind of early days, even though there's a lot of people who have, I think, some very passionate opinions about it.
One last topic, and that is fiber. Why do we need it? And do you differentiate between soluble and insoluble fiber within your cookbook?
So fiber is a type of carbohydrate that we don't digest. And so that's kind of where its benefit comes in. Because we don't break it down, it can do a couple of things. Soluble fiber acts like a gel. And because it acts like a gel, it helps to kind of sop things up along the way. And it also has some benefits for our gut bacteria. So our gut bacteria thrive on it. Insoluble fiber is like a pipe cleaner, and it helps to move things through, helps people to stay regular. But fiber is really kind of the star of the over 40 kind of health plan, really, because it's associated with all these improvements in our blood sugar and our cholesterol and really just our overall health.
And do you have recipes within the cookbook that speak to the need for fiber? And
absolutely. It's why it's one of the key ingredients.
So I'm Mr. Oatmeal for breakfast every morning.
Excellent. You would love my cookbook then.
I have a very, very particular recipe with cardamom and cinnamon, and like it's pretty specific.
Sounds delicious.
And you, what do you got to give us something.
Yeah, well, I'm a fan of overnight oats because my mornings are busy. I still have kids at home. Mornings are busy. So I love overnight oats. One of my favorites from the cookbook is key lime overnight oats. And it includes chia seeds and some Greek yogurt and soy milk and oats. And it's just really fresh and filling and delicious in the morning.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much.
That was Jen Salib Huber. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the science of healing and vitality on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Aaron Hartman's functional medicine journey began when traditional healthcare failed Anna, his adopted daughter with cerebral palsy. Despite being a physician, he felt helpless as specialists offered no solutions, only surgery and medications. Witnessing his daughter's impossible transformation shattered everything Dr. Hartman believed about medicine. This transformed his entire practice of medicine, and now he's become the doctor to turn to when all others have given up. He now helps patients reclaim their lives when conventional medicine says there's nothing more we can do. His book, Uncurable, From Hopeless Diagnosis to Defying the Odds, chronicles this transformation. A clinical researcher involved in 70-plus studies and VCU assistant clinical professor, he founded Richmond Integrative Functional Medicine in 2016. Welcome to the show, Dr. Hartman. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm super excited to be here.
So today we're going to have to bring you back another time to talk about your amazing journey because I find that fascinating. But today we're going to talk about something different, and that is your approach to dealing with obesity. To start with that, there was a study out of, I believe, Manchester in 2022 that suggests that there isn't just one type of obesity, but rather five related patterns caused by genetic, environmental, and lifestyle factors. Why was this study so important?
I think this study is important because people have been historically focusing on type 1 obesity, as I refer to it. It's just caloric in versus out. But the reality is, you know, that's the way things used to be before environmental toxins and chemicals, before all this new gene expression stuff, before a whole host of other things, inflammation. I mean, I could go through the five different types of obesity, but the gist is that because of the changing environment, now the old-fashioned stuff doesn't really work anymore when you get patients to change their diet. You have to work on inflammation. You have to work on their gut health. You have to work on detoxification. And even trauma, the nervous system, someone's nervous system can make you stay stuck in a metabolic state of dysregulation. And if you don't address those, people just stay overweight, even if they've done everything.
So you're new to the show, but regular listeners know that a little over 20 years ago, I lost 53 pounds and kind of changed my life. I was one of the types that is described in the study, and that's somebody who is obese or was obese because of emotional eating, so anxiety and stress-based. So what do you say to somebody who is an emotional eater or eats because they're anxious? What are the causes, characteristics, and treatments for somebody who has that type of obesity?
Well, like when you have that, when you're dealing with that kind of issue, that a lot of times it has to do with dopamine issues. And so you actually get this dopamine hit. There's a lot of interesting data on the idea of us humans being dopamine craving. And so all of a sudden there's this feed forward cycle where your sugar gets low, you eat food, and you get these craving cycles that get basically wired into your brain. With individuals like that, there are medications that work really well, but you have to literally work on changing neural pathways in your brain patterns. The medications can kind of feed the dopamine with drugs like Vyvanse that are actually FDA approved to treat binge eating disorder. And there's other medications like Wellbutrin, et cetera, but really, if you want to kind of quote unquote cure it, you have to actually change this dysregulated wiring in your brain, which takes behavioral change. It also takes thought pattern changes. And ultimately, the stimulus of food, you have to change how you relate with food.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a continuing journey. I can tell you that, right? I mean, I've struggled with weight my entire life. I'd love to tell you I've kept off all 52 pounds over 20 years, but you know, there's ebbs and flows and it is a full-time job. And I think that's what people don't appreciate. Another one of the types of obesity is diet-based or slash poor nutrition. And I, like from your perspective, is that about hyper-processed foods or is it about genetics? Like when we're describing somebody who's obese because of their diet and poor nutrition, what are the causes?
Well, the biggest single factor is ultra-processed food. And you can look at pictures of people in the 1950s on the beach. I have pictures of my grandfather in the 20s on the beach, and everybody was slender. And it's interesting how us eating more processed food, rancid fats, you know, seed oils, there's direct literature that seed oils can increase inflammation, affect your metabolism, and result in weight gain. Antibiotics in our food, people don't realize that 80% of antibiotic usage in the United States is actually the agribusiness. So we give this to animals, chickens, cows, and it actually makes them grow fatter quicker. So, you know, you put that in the food system and then you feed people, they get small amounts of antibiotics, they get seed oils, they get ultra processed foods that are nutrient deficient. And so you get this inflammatory state that all of a sudden now it's harder to lose weight than it was 30 or 40 years ago, because it's not just the calories, it's all the metabolic consequences of the complexity of food, and because we've just changed it so much.
So let's say there's somebody who is overweight and they're not eating the hyper-processed foods, and they're not eating late at night because they're not emotional, but they're just living a poor lifestyle otherwise, right? Because we know all about the interconnectedness of all things, right? Like it's your sleep and it's your exercise. So my understanding is that people who aren't moving are also susceptible to obesity, right?
Correct. Yeah, there's a saying that sitting is the new smoking.
Yeah.
Literally, our inactivity is driving a lot of this. And one thing that happens naturally is you lose about 1% of muscle mass every year and gain about 1% of fat mass every year, starting in your mid-20s. And so what that means is you're losing muscle, which is the primary driver of your metabolism, of how many calories you can burn off in a day. And if you do that for a decade, you notice how your body changes. So you get more soft, your body, you know, if you're a guy, you kind of lose the big chest and your weight kind of falls into your belly. And so over time, your weight will be stable, quote unquote, but you're losing muscle for fat. And you get this inflection point where you start gaining weight. And so that's where movement comes in, because movement helps maintain muscle mass. It helps maintain that metabolic edge, that if you lose it, then you have to lift heavy weights, do a hit, do all these other things to get that muscle mass back. And so maintaining it is the best thing to do, which staying physically active is a huge part of.
Which becomes harder and harder. Like, you know, I'm in my late 50s and, you know, my friends and I joke, exercise is what we do in between injuries. I'm dealing with tennis elbow right now, which is preventing me from doing my weights. And it's so frustrating.
Well, there's a whole host of things here. Once you get 50 is this one of these weird, mid-40s to 50 is one of these inflection points with how your body heals and the amount of inflammation in your body. So what that means is you just don't recycle protein as well as you used to. You just don't digest food quite as well. So all of a sudden you get this inflection point where getting adequate protein, getting enough collagen, you know, when's the last time you consumed bone broth or ate organ meat? You know, it's interesting how our connective tissues, which joints, ligaments, tendons, the right kind of protein and minerals for healing that actually comes from collagen, bone broth, organ meat that, you know, we don't eat anymore in our culture and society. You know, a lot of elite athletes now are using collagen. One of the reasons collagen has become popular recently is because we've actually realized commercially now too, the association between adipose collagen and hair, skin, nails, but also connective tissues. And so, you know, getting that right kind of protein nutrition and is a huge part, particularly as you get older.
The last two of the cohort of types of obesity seem to be more, how shall I put this, genetic and less environmentally impacted. And one of those is hormonal. So there are people who genetically just put on more weight and who have different hormone levels, which will impact inflammation, et cetera, correct?
Correct. Yeah. And hormones gets a little tricky because one of the things we've learned about hormones is there's chemicals in the environment called obesogens or neuroendocrine disruptors, which is a fancy way of saying these chemicals affect your nerves and your hormones. And so we're seeing more of that because of environmental toxicity, chemicals in the environment, and it has effects on your hormones, especially women. And you tend to store these chemicals in your fat. So one of the things your body does is actually kind of puts it, segregates it into fat tissue as a way to protect you. And if you keep on getting exposed to this over and over again, it can make your hormones worse and worse and worse. And women are especially susceptible to this.
And then there are just those people, you know, I wouldn't say, I don't want to use the judgmental term bad genes, but they are just more predisposed. Like, you know, like I have a bad metabolism. I just always have. And if I don't exercise, if I don't do all those things that we talked about previously, I'm going to pack on pounds faster than other people. That's a real thing, isn't it?
It is. I like to flip the script on that just a little bit.
Sure.
Because there's this thing called the thrifty gene hypothesis. And what it is certain people, certain ethnic groups have this thrifty gene, which 500, 600, 700 years ago was a survival advantage. If there's a fast or a famine, you know, you can't see me, but skinny guys like me would have died. And people who have this gene would have survived. We flip the script now where, you know, our poor are obese. Right? It used to be if you're poor, you're skinny, and our rich people were overweight. Now we flipped it. And
right.
Exactly. And so if you have this gene, you know, if you're a susceptible group, which is your Latinos, your Latin Americans, Native Americans are more well known to that, then all of a sudden you're more susceptible to all the processed foods and this constant caloric intake that we, you know, you're supposed to be fasting in the middle of wintertime. We gain weight in the winter and we lose it in the summer. Naturally, we're supposed to lose weight in the winter and gain it in the summer. We've literally flipped that.
I mean, that's my experience. It's completely flipped, right? Like I pack on the pounds in the winter, although I am active and get outside. Let's talk about how all these different factors interact, right? Because I don't think in today you could just identify one of those types of obesity that would explain all the obesity. Or like with somebody like me, I think it's a combination of things that kind of perpetuated me being overweight for so long. Is that what you see in your practice where there's, you know, there are different sort of elements, different types of obesity, or as obesity progresses, certain types of obesity take over? Like I would imagine, you know, if you have bad diet and you get to a certain size, well, then you're probably not moving. And that would make things worse from that perspective. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of different aspects to it. You know, when you're younger, when you have a bad diet, you can change it and lose the weight because you have less inflammation. You have more muscle mass. And as you age and get more of these hormonal abnormalities, now it's harder to lose weight. And one of the biggest hormone producers in our body is actually our muscles. They actually make these myokines, these muscle-based hormones, and fat makes hormones as well. So as you gain the weight, you almost transition from the caloric part to the inflammatory part. That's the toxic, which affects your hormones. And then as people lose the muscle mass, the metabolism gets wrecked. And then there's the whole neurological aspect on top of that. In our society, we have a phone-based society, tech-based society. What are screens doing? They're feeding that dopamine hit. You know, there's so many things. We've become a dopamine addicted. There's actually a book called Dopamine Nation that discussed our dopamine addiction. And some people meet it through just eating. And so you have all these things coming together and it changes throughout your lifespan and with your life experience. If you have personal trauma, physical, sexual, emotional abuse, some people actually will use eating as a way to cope with their trauma. And so you have to really figure out the individual, which ones you're dealing with, and you treat that one, you lose a few pounds, great. You stop, you treat this one, and you have to like literally walk through these. And a lot of my patients now have gotten so complicated, we spend a year or two just walking through each one of these step by step.
Makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
I really enjoyed it.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Colleen Hartwick, Cynthia Rivard, Jen Salib Huber, and Dr. Aaron Hartman. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, the Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.